Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead, and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. Simon Says, the John Simon Thriller, Book 1 by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Master Detective John Simon is a tough, streetwise 17-year veteran of the Kansas City Police Department with a healthy disdain for the encroachment of modern technology into his workplace. When his partner is kidnapped after a routine stakeout by thugs with seeming ties to connected, wealthy art dealer Benjamin Ashman, he's determined to find the truth. But the only witness is a humanoid android named Lucas George. Reluctantly, he takes Lucas along as he begins to investigate and soon finds himself depending more and more on the very technology he so distrusts. Meanwhile, Simon's precocious teenage daughter begins to teach Lucas how to sound more like a cop using dialogue from famous cop movies. If only he'd use them in the appropriate context. This exciting new mix of near-future science fiction and procedural thriller captures the gritty realism of Michael Connelly's Bosch, the humor and action of Lethal Weapon, and follows the classic science fiction tradition of Isaac Asimov's City of Steel. From the editor of the international best-selling phenomenon The Martian by Andy Weir, and the national best-selling author of tales including official entries in The X-Files, Predator, and the Joe Ledger thrillers, comes the action-packed first entry in an exciting new series. Be sure to pick up Simon Says by Brian Thomas Schmidt and get into the series on the ground floor. Vedic by KJ Heritage. The dead don't always die. Top company scientist Chin Jelinek has committed suicide. Vedic, a half-alive empath with no memory of who or what he is, will die in 6 hours if he can't find out why, or so the company tells him, an added incentive to get the job done. Our hero soon discovers he is one of the skilled, a genetically enhanced human revered and despised in equal measure, a bloodhound with a terrifying past who'll stop at nothing in his pursuit of the truth. And the skilled always get their guy, don't they? Vedic, number 1, by KJ Heritage, on sale now. There's a link to it in the show notes. KJ Heritage's uncanny sense of pacing and story puts him at the forefront of today's speculative fiction writers. Gritty, intense, and compelling, Vedic is something you don't run into often enough in sci-fi, a cerebral thrill ride you don't want to end. Prepare to lose sleep reading Vedic, delicious science fiction. That's what other people are saying about it. Find out for yourself. Vedic, the first book in the series by KJ Heritage. The Unwelcome Trilogy by R.D. Brady. survivor, mother, leader, and humanity's last chance. Deep within the remnants of the United States, Lila Richards oversees a camp of 200 survivors. In a world where living is an everyday struggle, and only through banding together can people survive, the arrival of the unwelcome only made her job harder. Riley Quinn and Miles Jones have been raised by Lila for the last 5 years. They're also one of the cursed, the children between the ages of 13 and 18, whom the unwelcome kill on sight. No questions, no pleas, just death. Protecting one another and the people of their camp is ingrained in all of them. But now each of them faces increased danger as the reason why the cursed have been targeted by the unwelcome slowly comes to light. And that truth will shock them to their core. Now time is running out, not just for the cursed who are being hunted down by the unwelcome, not just for Lila and her family who will face the greatest challenge yet, but for all of humanity. The world changed radically 35 years ago, but today humanity's very existence is on the line, and the fight has begun that will ensure its future or its annihilation. Fans of A.G. Riddle, James Rollins, Suzanne Collins, and Brandon Sanderson will love the Unwelcome Trilogy. Pick up your copy of the Unwelcome Trilogy on Amazon today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Jane Cockrum on the show with me today. She has a debut psychological suspense thriller. It's called The House of Brides, and this is one amazing debut. Welcome to the show, Jane.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you. Before we started recording, I was telling you that I've had a copy of the book for quite a while now, and it's really such an amazing read. I really didn't read over a lot of the press material when I picked up the book, and when I realized this was a debut novel, I said, oh, I've got to have Jane on the show. This is a fantastic book. The book is out everywhere now. It's called The House of Brides. So congratulations on the book launch.
Thank you. It's a very exciting time, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah. Jane, before we get into talking about all the good stuff, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, to be honest, I can't actually remember a time when I didn't want to be a storyteller or a writer. I've gone back in time and racked my brains, and it was just always something that was there. I think I grew up in a family of four children, so I was a mad reader because that was the only time I could shut myself away and in my room and have some quiet time. And I think it stemmed from that, going to the library every week with my parents and just that world of books and words and writing with somewhere I felt really safe and happy, and it was my own little world. So I think I wanted to be a part of that, and I started a family newspaper when I was really young, which I typed up every week, and I actually made my family pay for. And so I got the bug very early of writing for money, and from there it became my life. I've always worked with books and writing, and I don't know it any other way.
Do you remember the first book or a series of books or maybe an author that just completely captured your imagination?
Well, they were more as kids. I mean, a lot of kids still are like this, but I was always drawn into series. And the two that really got me were from the Northern Hemisphere. As a little Aussie child, there were the Enid Blyton boarding school series, like the Mallory Towers, the Sinclairs, and another series called Trebizond, which was not Enid Blyton, but was a similar vein. It was all midnight feasts, dormitory raids, hockey sticks. It was that whole other world that I found so thrilling and exciting. And the other one, which I love, the other series was Anne M. Martin's The Babysitter's Club from the US. So I loved going off into these worlds, which were so completely different from my suburban hometown in Australia. And after that, I was just sold on writing.
So many guests that I've had on the show have talked about having childhoods where they felt isolated from the rest of the world. Maybe it's a small farming town in Iowa, or it's a boarding school in England, or You know, it's in Australia that, but there's this this magic of books and stories that allow us to travel the world, you know, without leaving our bedrooms. And it's so awesome that you are a world traveler in your reading before ever leaving your home country.
It's so funny. And then as an adult or a young adult, when you actually get the chance to hopefully visit some of these places that you visit, they feel so familiar and almost as if you're coming home, which seems so crazy. But I know when I visited the US and the UK for the first time as a young adult, I felt like I knew all the ins and outs. Like I felt like a local.
Oh, that's so funny. did, you know, having the family newspaper and all of your family around you obviously saw this love of storytelling that you had, and you know that's a pretty precocious thing for, you know, a kid to do a family newspaper and then charge said family for the privilege of reading it. What did your parents and your family think of this obsession that you had?
Well, they have to say they humoured it. I know we had a family friend at the time who mocked up a layout for me, which, I mean, this was the days before home computers. So I used to type my newsletter up on my dad's typewriter from his office. So he would bring that home from work and I would sit up and type it up on these mock-up layouts that someone else had provided. Then I would send them back to work with my dad to be photocopied. And I mean, I'm sure he had better things to do with his time than to do my admin tasks. But so they obviously encouraged me and thought it was a bit of fun. And they also, as I got older and I wanted to drop all the subjects like chemistry and maths, which would have helped me in other careers, they were okay with that too. So they encouraged my love of literature and history and writing, which is nice. There's nothing more you can do for a kid than encourage their passions, I don't think.
Right. What about teachers? Did you have a teacher through school who encouraged you or saw this, you know, that you were on a path and that you had set your heart and mind to do this? Did anyone in school ever see that and encourage that?
Yeah, I think that there's so many along the way. I mean, everyone has a special teacher story or relationship, I think. There's always that connection, which is nice. But I definitely had teachers who early days would enter, poems in local competitions for writing, and then they would be published in student magazines, and they would encourage that sort of behaviour. And then as I got older, handing books to you that you might not otherwise come across as a young student. And I just think it's just every little bit of that encouragement is part of the journey. And I look back on quite a few teachers really fondly, actually.
I always love to hear those stories because, you know, there's some dark days as a writer sometimes where, you know, you know, can I do this? And you invariably pull back on those early encouragements. And I hear stories like that so often.
I think so too. And I think it's also when you run into people from your past who you might not have seen since school or university, and they ask you, oh, so are you writing? And you think, oh, that's been a part of who I am for so long, that you feel a little bit more encouraged that you're on the right track, I think. I think it's always nice to see people who remember you as someone who loved words and writing even as a kid.
Gotcha. How did you, when you got out of school and you start thinking about, you know, career paths and going to college, you've had this desire from early on that you want to be a writer and a storyteller. How do you start pursuing that?
So I think, I don't know about a lot of people, but I wasn't exposed to a lot of people who were writers and who wrote for a living when I was growing up. It was not a job that seemed, it didn't seem attainable. I felt like writers lived in ivory or sandstone castles somewhere in deepest England or in New York City. So I wasn't sure how to make the jump from wanting to be a writer to becoming a writer. The only thing I could think of was to study journalism at university. So I took that opportunity and I studied journalism, completed a journalism degree. But I was surrounded by students who were really they were hard news reporters. They were really keen to become foreign correspondents and travel internationally and work as breaking the big stories. I knew that I wanted to write fiction, which wasn't something that was really covered in that course. So I, instead of going into journalism when I finished university, I then took up further studies in publishing and got into the world of books that way.
So what was the first job that you had in publishing?
I had a job. I worked in the sales department for Pan Macmillan here in Melbourne. And I was just doing the administrative tasks, a lot of collating orders, sending out books for bookstores, just supporting the sales team, which was a very there was a lot of spreadsheets. There wasn't so much reading books by the fireplace as I had anticipated, but it was such a great entry into that world. And then I became a sales rep after that, which meant that I could go out and visit the bookstores every month and talk to them about the new releases, which I just loved going out and meeting. That was just my dream job, reading books and then talking about them to people. I mean, there's just nothing better for someone who loves books.
Oh, seriously, that's you know, that's a dream of so many kids. If I could just be around books all the time. I used to think that the perfect job would be to work in a bookstore, because you would get to see all the new books and then you could help steer people towards stuff that you love, that you think that they would love.
I agree. I would always get such a thrill when I would recommend something to a bookseller and I could tell they were about to pass on it, but then I convinced them to order it instead. And that was just such a buzz to be able to encourage someone to take a chance on a book that they might not otherwise.
Right. You spent a year in the West Country of England. What took you there, and what was it, work? Was it personal? And what was your experience there?
So that was a result, I think, of all the Enid Blyton as a child. I finished school and there was an opportunity to work in a boarding school in the deepest, darkest area of Devon, right near the edge of Exmoor. So I took that up and went, I think I was 17, and I went and lived in the boarding school and I looked after the small children and worked as a sports instructor, which would surprise anyone who knows me well, and generally was looking after a whole lot of little kids' well-being. And these were children who were at boarding school and they were as young as 6 and 7. So it was a big culture difference from where I'd grown up in the family home. And that was it was a beautiful, beautiful place. It was so remote. It was probably 20 minutes driving to the nearest village, set upon this gorgeous grass that was just green and hedgerows as far as you could see. It was really the most gorgeous English setting you could imagine.
That's as a kid, you talked earlier about the things that you read. When you actually get to go there in real life, you feel like you're coming home. Was it that kind of feeling when you got there?
Yeah, it was. And it was the people were – it was like meeting characters from all the books I'd read, meeting sort of the matron in the boarding house and the teachers and all the English children with their gorgeous accents going off in there with their lacrosse sticks. It felt like I was living in a movie set.
Well, the new book, The House of Brides, takes place in an English manor house. It's kind of centered around the story there. Did your time there sort of inform the kernel of the idea for this book?
It definitely did. I think I used a lot of how I felt as a young woman in a foreign place. I definitely used a lot of my experiences to inform how Miranda would feel in a setting that was so different and not having family support or friend support around her, and how that does change your behaviour and how you can reinvent yourself if you need to, and Miranda certainly needs to do that. But I was able to draw on that experience, I think, and even just the difference in just the small little day-to-day things that I found most noticeable when I was first exposed to them, like the smells, the sounds, the gardens, the plant life, it's just so different in England from what I had known. So I used a lot of those little jolting sort of sensory experiences almost to help the reader understand how discombobulated Miranda would have felt arriving at this beautiful English estate in the middle of nowhere.
Right. Had you, before tackling the House of Brides, had you written anything of this length before? Is this the first novel that you tackled?
I have written one full-length novel before, which rightly was not published. But it's all... it has been tucked away, never hopefully to be brought into the cold light of day ever again. But it's all practice, I think, even though that process is quite dispiriting at the time and you can have moments of complete crisis and doubt while you're writing a book that's never going to be published. It all adds up. I think Stephen King says something like the first million words are practice, which staring at a blank computer screen can be a little bit daunting, that thought. But I think it's true. I think we have a lot of words we need to get out of our system before we get to the nuts and bolts of it.
I've only met one, maybe two people out of the 750 or so interviews that we've done that published the first book that they wrote. And
Oh, right.
It's just not what happens. You know, those people are definitely the exception and not the rule. Most everyone has a book or seven, you know, in a desk, in a desk drawer or under a bed or somewhere. It's just, oh, you know, you have to get those out. And what's so weird is they feel so precious. I mean, all of the stories that we tell feel precious to us. We get invested in these characters and these settings and, you know, we want people to be transformed and transported and to fall in love with the characters, too. And then when the realization is, you know, that, well, these characters are going to go in the desk drawer or sit on a hard drive as more likely the thing to happen now. But after that experience with that book and writing it and realizing that, okay, well, I need to move on to something else. How did the House of Brides come to you? To kind of tag onto that, when you start thinking of a new story, what usually comes first? Is it a character? Is it a setting? Is it, a thought about a plot, you know, a what-if scenario? How does it usually start forming for you?
Yeah, sure. Well, firstly, I mean, I hope that all the other writers who have got a first manuscript tucked away feel as anxious as I do that it might be discovered by someone in the middle of the night and brought to light, because I think we need to put better locks on our desk drawers. I don't know, I can't speak for everyone, but after that experience, there's an element of having to drag yourself back up and start again, which is, it's sometimes a difficult thing to do. So for me personally, when I had gone through the process of that first manuscript, going out to agents and publishers and coming back with a lot of rejections, and sometimes really nice, constructive rejections, and sometimes people asking, what else do you have? And I was thinking, I don't have anything else. I just spent 3 years of my life working on this. I haven't had time to produce a spare. So I think I had to kind of almost trick myself into getting back into writing. So I told myself I would write something that I really loved reading, and that I would write a book that I wanted to read. And so I thought about what I loved about my favorite books, and it all came down to the same sort of things were kind of present in all my favorite books. There was always a really beautiful setting, a world that you could get lost in. It didn't have to be contemporary. It could be just a place in time that was so evocative. There was always a sense of mystery to the books and a slight psychological angle. And there was usually some sort of intertextuality. I always love those books that have letters and diaries and people writing from the past or other bits of books. So I thought, right, well, I'm just going to write a book like I like reading. So instead of thinking about sitting down at my desk again with great trepidation, I was actually starting to get really excited about it and thinking, this is a book just for me. This is not a book for anyone else. I'm just writing this for me to get back into the game. And then day by day, after a little while, I realized it was actually turning into a proper book. So it was all a bit of a mind game, to be honest, the way I got myself back in to writing. So, and I think out of that, your second question about what comes first to me, I think it really is for me a sense of place and putting characters into a certain situation that comes first. I always feel like they are the most evocative books of the books where the setting informs the plot or almost becomes a character in the story.
Yes.
So I think that's usually the little hook that gets me in, to be honest. I like to travel, and I like to read books about other, like, historical books, and so I think that's always a little nugget that gets me going.
I love a book where that, like you said, that the setting almost becomes a character. There are lots of great books that have been told in these sort of plain, nebulous settings where it could really be anywhere. Maybe it's more of an internal story, but I love to feel how the places we live in make us different, while allowing us to see our common humanity. There's something very if you tell a story that's set in Australia and or in Western England or the American South, how living in these places affect how people react and how they interact with one another. I just love when an author takes the extra steps to add that extra layer there. It makes the world building so much better.
I agree. And we have an author here in Australia called Jane Harper, who I know has had great international success, but she is an English writer who lives in Australia, and she writes about the Australian landscape. And even though I've lived in Australia all my life, the way she writes about it is so utterly transporting, the heat and the day-to-day logistics. And I think, wow, that is just amazing that a writer from the other side of the world can come here and show us something about our landscape that I haven't ever discovered on my own. I just think it's wonderful.
Right. So so you're writing the story for yourself. Do you feel like that is what really connected about this book, because you were not thinking maybe about the commercial viability of the story or whatever, comes into, everyone has stuff that you think about when you're writing, and should I make this decision or should I make that decision? But when a story really comes from a passionate place, from a place of this is what I really connect with, do you think that's where it becomes a story that other people connect with, because it is coming from such a personal, passionate place?
Yeah, I think maybe you're right, because I mean, I know you would have heard lots of writers say this, but I always hear writers say when they're trying to write a book to a market or to a trend, that's when they fall down and come across obstacles. So I think that sort of sense of authenticity, readers can detect that when they feel that someone is really writing from the heart and writing about something that they are connecting with or they feel deeply about or a passion, or their research is so meticulous. Readers are so savvy, and they are going to respond in the way that the writers are going to respond, but you can't trick a reader.
Right. Tell us a little bit about the story here, and who is Miranda?
So the story is Miranda. In Australia, we have a lot of, we call them influencers, people who are really successful on social media and who build a career out of giving people advice, posting beautiful photos, generally influencing how people's decisions and the way they live their lives. But there's also been a bit of fallout and I guess I think what in the US is called scam culture, where a lot of these people hit roadblocks in their careers and things fall apart quite quickly for them. So this is the case with Miranda, who is the main character in The House of Brides. She's a young woman who has hit a bit of a rocky patch in her career as a social media influencer. And so she is a bit lost. And one day she finds a letter at her father's house, which is addressed to her mother. and her mother's been dead for all of Miranda's adult life. So Miranda is being the quite obnoxious character that she is at the beginning. She opens the letter and is drawn into a sort of a decades-old family mystery from the other side of the world. And her mother grew up on a remote estate on the Cornish coast, and she wrote a famous book about it called The House of Brides. And then after that, she was mysteriously moved away from the family, and they've never had any connection again. So Miranda responds to this letter from her mother's family estate and travels to the UK, and she's hoping to find out some more about her mum and what happened and why she left and came to Australia. But when she gets there, she finds quite a mysterious situation, and she's drawn into a more modern day mystery, and she tries to uncover both what's happening now and also what happened to her mother all those years ago.
When you started writing it, did you envision these first the path that Miranda was going to take and how the plot was going to unfold? At what point, when you're kind of feeling out this story, did you start realizing, like you said earlier, oh, this is a proper book? And, you know, how did you then, kind of come up with a personal plan on how to take this little passion project you were working on and finish this out?
So I think one of the other inspirations for this book, and another way I got into writing it, was drawing on one of my favourite books of all time, which I know is a favourite of a lot of readers, which is Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. So that was a real jumping off spot for me, was looking at that classic story and thinking about it within a modern framework, and how a young woman who is brought up with some agency and some go and some nous about them, how they would respond in that sort of situation, being thrust into a situation where really they don't have a lot of control or power over what is happening. So that was it was sort of a jumping off point for me, and that was the inspiration for Miranda going back to this estate, which does have shades of Manderley about it for people who are fans of Rebecca. And I think the point where I thought this is actually a book was when Miranda took on a life of her own, and she started to behave in ways that I hadn't foreseen when I started writing the book. So she became a character, and she started doing things that that a modern woman would do. So I think that was a fun point to kind of let that unspool and see where it took me.
Did you have an idea of the ending when you began?
I did have an idea of the ending. I had an idea of how I wanted the readers to feel at the end. I had a feeling of how I wanted to end up in terms of Miranda and how her relationships with the women in the book. But I wanted it to be a bit of a twisty, gnarly path to get there. So I kind of let myself just follow Miranda and trust that she would get me there in the end, which she does.
I know that this book began a little differently than a lot of novels do. But do you consider yourself a pantser or a plotter or something in the middle?
I think, like everyone, it's a little bit of both. I think I like to plan to a certain amount, and I love drafting. I'm a real fan of writing a lot of drafts. So, and I think even though I tell myself I'm pantsing, I think what I'm really doing is writing a really elaborate plan in the first draft. I think I've somehow tricked myself into thinking that I'm a pantser, and I'm really not. So I think that's my technique. I write a very elaborate first draft, which probably in other people's minds would be a plan.
Well, I have a friend, Josh Hayes, who's a very successful science fiction writer, and we kind of have this ongoing argument about plotting and pantsing. It's not really an argument. We kind of have fun with it. He is a hardcore planner. I'm talking about, Excel spreadsheets, all different colors tracking, characters and where they show up. And I mean, he is all about the details and having a serious plan. And what we realized in a conversation we had one time is that we all are outliners. But some of us outline the book after the book is written.
and some of us beforehand. He likes to do his beforehand. Mine comes out more afterwards, and I think we call that revision.
Exactly. It's all semantics, isn't it?
It is. But you love the drafting process. Some people love editing, and having they're not real fans of the initial, first draft and really getting the shape of the story out. But they thrive in the, okay, I could take the parts that I've created now and now really hone those and polish them. And how do you feel about the editing process?
I feel like it's such a treat, I think, because once you get to the editing process, it means that you have done that work, that scary work of getting the framework of the book down on the screen, which, I mean, that is quite daunting. But I know that you might only have a very flimsy framework at that point, but it's so true what they say about you can't edit a blank page. It's just, I've learned that over the last couple of years, that as soon as you have something on paper, you're already in front. So I think the editing process, and it's also the part where you can start to have a bit of fun, I think. You can start to play with the dialogue and, really build up your characters and add all those little twinkly bits that make the story a little bit more unique, I think, in the drafting and the revision and the editing. And I also think the other real treat as a published writer is the fact that people, once you get a publishing deal or an agent, people are actually giving you this amazing feedback about your book, which is, for some, I know some writers don't enjoy that process, but I love the fact that someone is taking the time to read my book so intricately and come up with these fantastic ideas and feedback. And I think there's no more sort of greater privilege than having someone who really is going to sit down and read your book so intently.
Right. And have something constructive to offer in the end and not just be an internet troll.
Oh, I agree. And I think, some people ask, how do you deal with people giving you criticism or feedback? And I just say, I love it. Like, it's just because you're sitting in a room at the library, you're just typing away and thinking and just making all the decisions on your own. And it's just nice sometimes to have someone there holding your hand and saying, no, maybe try this. Or one of my greatest milestones so far has been when my agent, Rob Weisbach, got involved in the editing process. And some of the comments he made were so helpful and just really transformed the entire book. So I would never say no to constructive feedback.
When I was reading the book, I found myself several times through the book just with an unsettled feeling.
No.
It's I love it. I love suspense thrillers and a book that will kind of put you off center a little bit. And several times I would stop and I would think, why am I so nervous about what's going on here? And that is a huge compliment. And that, I love to read something that unsettles me while I'm in the comfort of my, safe and cozy home. when you're writing a book like this, I would catch myself with, like, what is it about this book? What are these trope is not the word I'm looking for. Kind of these set pieces that trigger things in us. We've got the big gothic house, and we've got this family, and there's lots of secrets, and all of these things that just make us feel unwell inside.
In
the best possible way. Yeah, because, we seek out these kinds of books because we want to feel that way. As you're writing this, are you conscious of those elements of the story that are coming in? And I guess to kind of continue that, there are certain things we expect in a particular genre. Are you thinking about genre at all when you're writing, and readers will expect this ever so often, or does that come into the planning at all?
So I guess with this one, it did a little bit. I was, as part of my fun game with myself, I was playing a little bit to those tropes that we've come to love and expect in those great gothic novels and those sort of those country house mysteries, I suppose, to a lesser extent, like the Agatha Christies and the Jane Eyre and Rebecca and that feeling of just never fully knowing the entire story. So I was playing a little bit to those gothic tropes about your sort of the unanswered questions and the sinister, trying to build that sinister feeling that you do get in those kind of closed in situational books. But I was also writing a book that I wanted to keep writing, so I wanted to keep myself on edge, I guess, and it's a delicate game though, because you want to tease things out, but you don't want to frustrate the reader either. So I think as a reader, I know sometimes you almost feel like you need to fling the book across the room in frustration sometimes when there's too many unanswered questions or too much suspense. You feel like you're being a little bit manipulated. But I know as a reader, I respond well to having those sort of tense moments, I guess, and knowing a little, but never really knowing the full amount until it's time to know the full amount.
Right. Well, The House of Brides is out everywhere now. It's been out for about a week now when you're hearing this, and available in hardback, in Kindle edition, and audiobook. There are two different covers for this book, Jane, for the Australian edition and the American edition. And they give me kind of two different feelings when I look at the cover art. Do you have a favorite?
I agree, they are so different, and
They are.
I look at them and I think, wow, it's like I've written two different books, really. Both of them, it's funny, it's almost like you could have the A side and the B side. Like, I think the US edition, which is the very dark, quite creepy image of the interior of a really like a rather grand mansion and the red chair on the front, that is very spooky and very, I think that invites you in and it's very mysterious. Where I think the Australian one suggests a little more about the plot and it gives a bit more of an indication of the young girl who's a little bit panicked, shall we say. But I think they complement each other nicely. I think they carry both elements of the story together. But yeah, it's a little, yeah, it is like I've written two books there.
Well, I absolutely love it. This is one of my favorite books of the year.
Thank
Jane,
you.
you're very welcome. Thank you for writing this book. Are you working on another novel now that this one is out in the world and off your plate?
I am working on another novel, and as we discussed earlier, it's still very much at that drafting slash planning slash writing the first sort of bare bones framework. But yes, I'm getting there, and it's very I think readers of House of Brides will respond. It's the same sort of the story of I'm really interested in young women and their journey through the world and the secrets they leave behind and the family connections. So it will definitely involve those elements again.
Well, please come back on the show and talk to us about the new book when it comes out. I know it's going to be fantastic, like House of Brides is.
Oh, thank you so much. I definitely will.
Jane, if people are just learning about you and want to connect with you online and follow along with all the great news we know that'll be coming from your writing career, is there a place where they can find you online and connect with you?
Sure. I'm on Instagram and my handle is @JaneCockramAuthor. I'm fairly new to the platform, so I'm just getting the hang of it. So you might need to be patient as I learn how to work it. And I also have a website, which is www.janecockram.com.
Excellent. We're going to put a link to the book, The House of Brides, in the show notes of this episode, where you can go buy your copy of it. And we'll also link up your Instagram and your website as well. Jane, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Welcome to historic Sleepy Hollow, settled in 1640. Jason had looped around the town and had come up Broadway from the south. Behind the retaining wall next to the sign, a yard worker turned on his leaf blower, sending a tidal wave of yellow and red up and over the stones to splash off the windshield of the RV. They passed antique shops, a Shell station, and a Food King grocery.
"This is the same Broadway, you know," said Eliza. "It goes all the way down to Times Square. Used to be an Indian trail, Manhattan to Fort Orange, for the fur trapping business."
She kissed the dog.
"Oh, don't worry, baby. Nobody's gonna skin you. And you know what the town's most famous for?"
"Well, duh," Jason said. Every kid named Crane, especially one as tall and skinny as Jason, had heard a lifetime of Ichabod jokes. He hoped never to hear another.
"Did you know it was a real place?"
"Of course," he said, though he hadn't.
"Don't be so smart," said Eliza. "Turn here."
The streets sloped towards the Hudson, the hillside trying to shake the village off its back. Jason slipped in behind a UPS truck and drove upwards. They turned onto Gory Brook Road. He stuck his head out the window, trying to pass. The UPS truck turned aside to the right. And he saw the house.
"Here! Here! Here!" said Eliza.
She pointed at the driveway of 417 Gory Brook. Jason brought the RV to a smoke-belching halt. The house stood on a knoll, above a steep yard that angled downwards toward the Hudson. An ancient sycamore on the front lawn leaned precariously. The roof was an irregular A-frame, with a long slope on the left and a short one on the right, like a rotated checkmark. The upper floors were trimmed with bands of chocolate-brown wood in a rectangular pattern. They made the house look as if it were trapped behind the bars of a jail cell. A tiny triangular portico extended over the front door, which was rough-hewn, rounded on top, held together by two vertical metal bands, and dotted with nail heads, a Gothic novel in Braille. The gray-blue curtains at the ground-floor bay window gave the place a veiled eye aspect, like his grandmother's cataracts. The house seemed to be inspecting Jason with that eye.
"What are you doing here, boy?"
"I'm watching you."
Eliza put a hand on his shoulder. He jumped.
"This is it," she said.
She slapped the dashboard. "This is what?"
"Our new home."
"But..." Jason turned to her, baffled. Her face sparkled with delight.
"Surprise!"